excuse me. Clear my throat a little bit.
The cassette we are now using is excellent.
Very good.
I'm finding another kind of cassette. We actually reached St. Paul's days in the chronological way.
We talk about Marmorstein and all that.
Yes. It was an extension.
Well, from St. Paul's.
It was very interesting. And I have some questions now to Paul, particularly the relations between him and Elika Doring. By the way, I read the introduction you told me of Elika Doring's book.
Well.
Did you read it?
Oh, yes.
Well, it was interesting.
He published it separately.
I see.
He sent it to me.
I see. Well, I think he ought to publish it only separately and not with the book.
Well, he has done already, probably.
But it is interesting. It is interesting indeed. I mean...
It's full of... he still feels vindictive, I mean, so...
Yes, all right. So now I wonder, I think, let's today stop for a while the chronological story, though we'll come back to it. We'll come back mainly to the Oxford days, particular between your undergraduate days and let's say the late 30s. We'll follow it. What I want to try today is, in a way, to follow your, if I may say so, intellectualist biography. Of the way you, or what do you remember of the process, if you do remember, of forming your opinion? Now, let's put it this way. You have you have developed through the years, hello.
We just begun. Where's all the lead? Where's all the lead?
So, you have developed through the years some beliefs, let's not call them principles. Let's say pluralism and against monism. Let's say strong, I would say, a belief against the tyranny of one concept. Be it even rationalism, the responsibility of the individual, anti-determinism, the role of the individual in history or in social life. One can say that you are supporting, it's not supporting, but you are romantic. I mean, it's romantic that appeals to you more than rationalism, and in a way, romantics appeal to you more than classic. Or am I right in this?
No, this is wrong.
Oh.
I'll tell you what I mean, or even rationalism. I was brought up in the strict doctrine of Oxford empiricism, and my interest in these other things are as a kind of antidote. I thought it was too narrow. In a sense, I still hold it. But I've always been fascinated by what the opposite side says. And therefore, when I discovered all kinds of things which appeared incompatible, I always, in that sense, try and strengthen the opposition to views to which I'm normally addicted. I can't be said I'm not against, let's say, French worship of reason in the 18th century. I'm not in favor of whatever it was Voltaire attacked, in favor of superstition or obscurantism or even emotionalism of any kind. But one, given the narrowness and the obvious insufficiency of these doctrines, I become fascinated by what is against them. And so then I oscillate between the two. I never take sides. That's one of my weaknesses, maybe strengths, maybe weaknesses. That in some sense I sort of shy from one to the other and try to work out, not a synthesis, that's not right, but some kind of personal unstable compromise between them. If you ask me, when did all this begin? After the war.
After
the war? Yes. I can't remember this length of years. God knows, I don't know what I believed in the 30s. I was a perfectly ordinary Oxford philosopher. I believed in empiricism. I believed in certainly some kind of rational approach. I was, so to speak, hostile to metaphysical speculation. Although I'd been taught that when I was an undergraduate, I reacted against it. And in favor of what later came to be called Oxford philosophy or common sense philosophy. That is my natural tendency. I was really a traditional, empirical, rather middle of the road empiricist. I was never a logical positivist, and I was never an anti-logical positivist. I found that logical positivism was fallacious in some ways, did not explain things, skated too lightly over things, and a lot of faults, of which I was very well aware, and which I expounded even in the 30s, when I had to talk to Fred Ayer about his book, which was a manifesto of logical positivism in his day, 1935, that was. At the same time, I didn't, so to speak, react in the direction of historicism or metaphysics or some older philosophy of that kind. But insofar as Ayer could be regarded as left-wing and the metaphysicians were right-wing, I stood in some kind of mildly liberal position, which is my usual state of my usual spiritual condition. And that's why I was constantly at odds with both the left and the right, which I remain to this day.
Yes.
But all the things you talk about, I think happened after all. I'm not quite sure why or when. They did.
For a second in Oxford days. Did it mean that you preferred Aristotle to Plato? Did you argue
no.
in those terms?
No.
At all in those
no.
Days?
No. No. I didn't take particular interest in Greek philosophy.
Good, sorry. Yes. Why?
I didn't.
That's fine.
Well, I don't know. I studied it as an undergraduate. It was all written in Greek, which is a language I never really learned properly. After 6 years of learning Greek at school, I was never a Greek scholar. And what impressed me was English philosophy, not French, not German. English philosophy beginning with, roughly speaking, I suppose, John Stuart Mill. Not so much 18th century. I came to, well, Hume, yes. Hume, certainly. Not Descartes, not Locke, not really Berkeley, Hume and the whole empirical tradition. Mill, followed by Russell, Moore, all of whom were writing at this time, particularly G. Moore, who had an influence on me. And then you see Austin, my colleague Austin, became Fellow of All Souls in 1933. I became Fellow in 1932. We had long discussions about philosophy, most mornings, from 10 o'clock till always lunched. I had pupils, he had pupils, but not that many. And he influenced me very greatly in the direction of careful dissection of arguments, in the direction of not biting off more than one can chew, and chewing and chewing and chewing, in the direction of careful analysis of exactly what one meant and exactly what one believed and what were the negative cases which knocked out rather too easily believed in generalizations. That was the effect on me. I remember, for example, even then, I think I believed in freedom of the will. And I was very puzzled by the problem of freedom of the will, by determinism, which I instinctively reacted against. And I remember determinism, even in those days. It was not instinctively. It was not, I think maybe because my tutor at Corpus was in favor of free will, Michael Hardy, after he became president of Corpus. He just was one of the few people who believed in freedom of the will. Most philosophers from Plato onwards are determinists, from then till now. Number of people who want to believe in pure freedom of the will is very, very small throughout history. And I think he may have infected me with his belief, but I held on to it from then till now. And Austin once said to me, people talk about determinism. Have you ever met a determinist? They all say they are, but have you ever really met one? That was a typical Austin move. They say they are. I've never met a determinist. I don't think you have either.
I tend to think that there is something in the nature of somebody, if he, from the very beginning, is against determinism. It's something not only...
Oh, I think so. It's a matter of temperament.
I'm sure.
Most philosophy is a matter of temperament. Fichte was the first man who said that. That if you want to understand the philosophy, you must ask who the man is and what his psychology is, and then you'll understand why he believes what he believes.
Is it why, when you decided to deal with the history of ideas, you deal with it through the men and not through abstract ideas?
It could well be.
I think so.
Could well be. I think one of the factors which confirmed me in my anti-determinism was writing a book on Karl Marx, which began then.
That's what I would have ever assumed.
It began then. You see, I was invited to write the book on Marx in 1933, as early as that, by Mr. Fisher, warden of New College, and editor of the Bloom University Library, one of the three editors, the others being Gilbert Murray, and I think somebody else. And he first offered this book to Lasky, who refused. He then offered it to Frank Packard, now Lord Longford, who also refused. Then I think he was in despair, and he suddenly thought about me. He knew me because I taught at New College, and I used to go to lunch with him, and he didn't detect any strong political belief in me at all. He thought that would be the thing. I would know the languages, I was a foreigner. I would understand one. Anyhow, he asked me if I would do it just for a shot in the dark. But my view was, I'd never read a line of Marx before this happened. Not a line. But, of course, I used to talk about socialism with my friend Rachmilevich, whom I mentioned to. So I knew the Mensheviks believed roughly, what the Bolsheviks believed roughly, what the difference between them were, but not the doctrine itself, at least only superficially insofar as it entered into history of the Russian Revolution.
The Socialist Club, did you discuss Marxism there?
Not Socialist Club, I was not a member of Socialist Club. You have no socialist club, no. There was a thing towards the end of the 30s, which was a luncheon club called the Pink Club. They were not all socialists. Some were liberals, some were communists. I never belonged to a... I probably voted for the Labour Party, but I never was a member of the Labour Club, for example. No. And I don't know what discussion there was. I mean, I wasn't a pupil of Kohl or took no part in those discussions. I was simply a member of the Pink Lunch Club because it was anti-appeasement, anti-Nazi, because it was big anti-the government, but for no other reason, really. There wasn't much ideology. It was a club which used to meet in after 35 or so, 34, 35, 36, that sort of time, simply to hear the views of people in the Labour Party, German refugees, interesting people of more or less left of centre.
Who was the central figure?
Kohl. He founded it. That's correct. I can tell you who the other members were, since we are wandering from the subject. I can tell you who they were, quite interesting. If we take something like 1937, typical year. Crossman, Kohl, Gordon Walker, Pakenham, Stewart, Austin, Roy Harrod, afterwards became very conservative. James Mead, who was an economist, afterwards got a Nobel Prize, who was never a socialist. It was anti-conservative, anti-Chamberlain is what it was, anti all that, anti-Baldwin, anti-conservative, anti-the government, anti-the whole right wing in England, and all its ideas. It was it was more or less pro-League of Nations, it was anti-German, anti-Japanese, anti-fascist, it was against what might be called the force of darkness. It's what the Russians called, so to speak, forces of light. Typically, it was liberal.
Yes.
Christopher Hill was a member, certainly. A man called Hugo Jones, who afterwards became famous Roman historian, wrote a book on Herods. Well, I think he was probably a crypto-communist by then, but we didn't know it. Very left-wing. And his wife, who certainly very, very left-wing. Who else were members? Rouse. A.L. Rouse in those days. Third? Of course. Geoffrey Hutz was an early Zionist. Always in favor of Zionism. By pure inner thought. He had no particular inclination, I mean, no reason why he should have been. He simply said, British government backed the wrong horse as far as the Arabs are concerned. Simply made up his mind. Very careful thinker, very well read. He began collecting newspaper cuttings at the age of 14 at school. He was an independent thinker, mainly interested in the Far East. But he was entirely independent. He simply made up his own mind on the evidence. I've never known a more disinterested, more independent, a more careful thinker. He might have been wrong, but it was never because he was influenced by anybody or had any axe to grind. Never. He was certainly a member of voted Labour, probably because he was sort of liberally inclined, but he was never a socialist, in the full sense, never. Then who else came? Winter Hudson certainly came. It was always very devastating. The people produced general propositions in a very slow, halting, almost sort of broken voice. You would produce five powerful counterexamples. That would settle that. That was his technique.
So from there you couldn't learn about Marxism?
No. I was already knew about Marxism by then. Because having been instructed to write a book, I asked myself whether I should. Now, one thought occurred to me. It looked to me as if Marxism was something which was going to develop, not decline. In view of Russia, in view of communists everywhere, in view of the whole battle, Nazis and communists and so on.
It was 35?
33. And I thought, well, if I don't write a book about Karl Marx, I'll never discover what it's about, because it's frightfully boring to read. When I tried to read it, stupefyingly dull for me. But I thought, unless I forced myself to read it, I would never find out. And on the whole, I didn't want, simply didn't know nothing about it. I never read Freud, for example, and always regretted it. At least I read Marx. So I said, settle down. Nobody.
Nobody. And then you took it upon yourself. Did it take your friends by surprise?
I don't think anyone knew. I don't think it was now known. I was doing it, but I don't think I talked about it very much.
And while writing, did you discuss it?
I began writing quite late, as is usually my habit. I accumulated quite a lot of stuff. I read Marx partly in German, mainly in Russian, because there were these excellent Russian, also in 1933, the Gesamtausgabe, the edition of Marx Engels, stopped in Germany because of Hitler, but went on in Moscow. So I was able to go on reading the big edition, absolutely everything. I didn't just read the famous works. I read the letters, I read minor works, I read whatever the Russians in Moscow published, volume by volume, 22 volumes, whatever it is. I read far more Marx than will ever be good for anyone to read again. That's certainly true. And trust it, perhaps in order to stop myself from writing, which was a painful process, of course. And so I learned quite a lot about it. Did I, when I began, what did I read? I read everything I could lay my hands on. And particularly Plekhanov was my favorite reading, because he was amusing, he was witty, he was brilliant, he was sharp, he was not great flat stretches like Kautsky. I was happy to discover that my opinion of Kautsky was shared by Marx. He met him, you know, and then wrote a letter to Engels saying, "You never met such a boring man in all my life." And Bernstein had some difficulty knowing whether to publish the letter or not. Anyway, and in the course of doing these lectures on Marx, I began reading the French 18th century encyclopedists, because Plekhanov read a book about them, which fascinated me because it was extremely clear and very well written. And that gave me my first knowledge of these people. And that gave me an interest in the history of ideas as such. Because the reading, whatever it was, I mean, Helvetius, Holbach, Condorcet, not so much Voltaire, but these sort of ideologists of the French left in the 18th century began to fascinate me in itself. That's when I began to lecture on it too. Towards the end of the 30s, I began lecturing on French political thought. It was not very well, not a central subject in Oxford, but still people came. And that's when I lectured on Hume's political and ethical thoughts, which again was not very widely, that people didn't take much interest in those days. So it really, Karl Marx, you got me going. And the more I read Marx, the more it appeared to me, A, he was a genius, and B, he was wrong. A genius because he obviously put a, I mean, I didn't, not because he was original, there isn't a single idea in Karl Marx which cannot be traced to some earlier thinker. Not one. But the synthesis is unique. And he put certain things on the map. He, to speak, emphasized aspects of history and aspects of social structure, you know, social history, really, social life, which nobody else had emphasized to such a degree, and that's become common possession of everybody now. I mean, class war was invented by, in the 18th century, by Saint-Simon in Britain, and surplus value was invented by Michael Hodgkin in England, long gone like this. It was the, what? It's the 19th, yes, 1830s. Hodgkin. He was long gone like this. I mean, capital proletariat was an idea of what's his name, von Stein, who went to Drangensteinerstal, don't remember his name, who went to Paris, conservative German, who went to France and described what he called the proletariat, and it's working, and so it goes on. You see, for example, dialectic obviously comes from Hegel. The whole anti-religious polemic comes from the young Hegelians. Materialism comes from the 18th century. Or even earlier. The normal view, well-known view, certainly. What else can we attribute to Marx? Big business, he invented. The idea of big business begins with him. The conception and the inference of enormous sort of business. I mean, Saint-Simon talked about that sort of thing, but the idea of big business as an institution, employing the proletariat, if they can, creating a kind of ideology of its own, which would dominate society, I think, was really his. That can be said. And another thing, well, never mind, I don't want to lecture on Marx now. But anyhow, that's what happened then. And I suppose his determinism was something which I couldn't swallow. And it appeared to be clear that certain turns in history could not be explained. The proposition which I least believed was Engels' famous proposition, that if Napoleon had not existed, a lot of other people between them would have produced the same effect. As somebody once said, I can't remember who, Napoleon, Napoleon d'Or was a Napoleonic coin. It was under the first Napoleon and under the third. Change for a Napoleon is not a Napoleon. And that I think is what appeared to me absolutely clear. It seemed to me that people like Frederick the Great or Napoleon gave a push, gave a twist to history, which was might not have occurred, given the forces at play. That's my objection to Braudel and all that. And all that. The idea that individuals don't count. The big movements are huge impersonal movements due to geography and climate and all that. I don't speak of class war. Seems to be deeply implausible. Although perhaps we didn't pay enough attention to them before. That can be said.
So even there, I think people are exaggerating.
No, certainly. There's quite a good article in the current copy of the New York Review books by what's his name? Stone. Not Norman Stone.
The American Stone.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I haven't.
In fact, Englishman. What was his first name? Old friend of mine. Lawrence Stone.
Lawrence Stone.
Which is a review of the book by...
Lawrence Stone is an Englishman? I thought he was...
Comes from Oxford. Lawrence Stone lives in Oxford during vacations. Has a house in Oxford. Pupil and enemy of Trevor Owen. Purely. Terribly English. And he's a professor at Princeton, yes.
Ah, that's why.
Oh, yes. But the thing about him is that... it's an article in the New York Review Books reviewing... All right. An article in the New York Review Books reviewing Miss Gertrude Himmelfarb's book, which is a great attack on this kind of thing, on impersonal history, on Marxism, on the general sociology, and it's quite a fair review. It says she exaggerates, goes too far, but there's a lot more she says. It's approximately true. Too much passion, too much having Crystal, which was her husband, but nevertheless, it's quite a respectable review. She's worth reading the book. It's called The Old History and the New, it's called.
I bought it.
You bought it. Can it be bought in England?
Yes.
It can. In Blackwell. She's quite a clever woman.
I haven't heard
it. It's fanatical. It's a denounces everybody and attributes Marxism to non-Marxists. You can imagine. Traces it everywhere. When I once, in front of, I once had a sort of symposium with her in New York, one of the trilling seminars, as it was called, and made some disparaging remark about Edmund Burke. She was very angry with me. Burke was an ally, not an enemy. Anyway, continue. So that's when I think my interest in history of ideas came. But the whole business about individualism and conflict of values and pluralism and all that, that's later. That's after the war. Certainly. That's when I read Vico, that's when I read Machiavelli, that's when all that happened.
And now, still, when you wrote the biography of Marx, your instinct probably was against determinism. And then, not only the instinct, you had the examples.
I can't deny one thing. My attitude to Marx was not uncolored by my attitude to the Soviet Union. It couldn't but be. It may be wrong, it may be that this bias was stronger, but on the whole, I didn't really want Marx to be right. But I was deeply impressed. And if you read my book, you'll see that I give him his due. So much so that some people thought I was a Marxist.
When I read your book, I was in a stage of a vehement anti.
Yeah.
And I thought that you gave him...
Too much. Too much.
Yes, I'm too much now.
I understand. The point about my book, the best thing to be said about my book, so much attacked and some of them praised, was that nobody by reading this book could tell what my political views were. That I think is perceptibly true about me then. It was clear that I was not a conservative. It was not clear that I was a liberal socialist or what I was. That I was not a communist, not a Stalinist was clear. That is, yes, that's why I was attacked by communists.
When you publish your book, your friends who were more to the left, what was their...
Stuart approved, on the whole, I think you read it, bits of it. Freddie, I read bits of it. Various people did, Rachmilevich did, to some extent.
Did you discuss with him while writing?
He didn't read it. But while writing, no. I don't think I did. No. He was not an authority on Marx's precise views. No, I didn't. Stuart, I think, quite approved. I don't remember what Stuart thought. Freddie, I didn't make read a chapter or two. He was then very left-wing. More than he is now. Wills read it for me. I think I acknowledge in the introduction who I made read it. Not many people. No, I think Rachmilevich did read bits of it. But most people were astonished that I should have written it. Nobody knew I was writing it. Because I was an ordinary Oxford philosopher teaching logic and theory of knowledge and the ordinary Oxford subjects. And Marx didn't come into that at all. It's an entirely different side of my mind somehow. When it appeared very late. It was only printed in 13... Well, the original version is exactly twice the size of what appeared. I tried to get it published by some other publisher in full, but Fisher kept bullying me and said, I must do it through that, and I must abbreviate it. So I spent about 9 months shortening each chapter, which was agony. It was terrible kind. Drops of blood. And lots of left out, which I originally said. Which I destroyed in a kind of enraged manner. I didn't keep it.
Otherwise later you could
have... I threw it away in a very exasperated way. And then I certainly did. I never valued anything I did. I never kept anything because I thought it might be worth it. Never. And my opinion of my writings is not high, I assure you. Never has been. I mean, some things are worse than others, but that's about all I can say. But it only appeared 39, the book itself. It got some very funny reviews. It was reviewed quite favorably in the TLS Anonymous, I don't know by whom. It was reviewed, nobody praised it much. It was attacked badly in New Statesman by a man called Postgate, Raymond Postgate, who had written a little book on Marx himself, and who pointed out perfectly correctly two errors of dates. I think I called the July Revolution, the June, the days in the July or something, and something else like that. He thought it was a very, very bad book. In the Daily Worker, it received what was to me rather an agreeable review. It said it was certainly wrong and should not be placed in the hands of decent comrades, but it showed the progress which the bourgeoisie had made since the crude attacks of an earlier period. That was written by Michael Campbell, who was involved in the Zinoviev letter, famous communist figure. It was received a violent attack by a man called, not Hatton, but something other like that. In the Labour Monthly, whatever the communist periodical was, which he kept on talking, our Oxford Marxophile. That's our tone. On the whole, it fell dead born. Nobody read it then. It made no impression at all. None. Then the war started. Insofar as it was read after the war. And all that, yes. I think his name was Hutton, the man who attacked me. I think so. Can't remember his first name. Well, then communist for that period.
Now, did writing the book on Marx raise your opinion in the role of personalities in history and the role of thinkers in history? I mean,
yes. It made me think that the Russian Revolution would not have occurred if certain individuals had not lived. For example, Marx. For example, Lenin. For example, Trotsky. That the very success of Marxist doctrines refuted the downgrading of the role of individuals or ideas in history, particular ideas. And I became convinced that what Heinrich Heine said was true. There's a famous passage which Heine says, do not, so to speak, think to the downgrade or whatever it is, do not ignore or despise the quiet philosopher in his study. These are very dangerous people. If Kant had not beheaded God, Robespierre would not have beheaded the king. These people, ideas are very dangerous and influential things. Then that famous passage about what would happen in Germany, which communists love quoting. Famous passage about telling the French not to disarm. I think he would have been against disarmament of the West at all points, Heine. There's a famous passage when Engels said to Marx, that considering Heine's terrible hostility to the 1848 revolution, something should be written against him. Marx said, not a word. He's one of the most intelligent people alive. Certainly not. He was a friend. He didn't care what he said. I mean, he liked him very much. Heine was violently anti-socialist.
Now, when you wrote about Marx, have you already been well acquainted with Russian thinkers, or was it through...
It was through Marx that I began really seriously reading Plekhanov. I didn't think I did it as an undergraduate. No, because of Marx, that I began reading these people. I didn't know anything about Russian thinkers. Well, Herzen I read, certainly when I was in the Now, I discovered him purely by accident in the London Library. The name was known to me. Purely by accident. I knew the name. I can tell you exactly what happened. The name is the name which vaguely was referred to by people writing about, I don't know, the Russian 19th century. I may have come across it in that, and I don't know, Dr. Akhmelevich probably mentioned him. But I thought he was just some pompous publicist in the 19th century of no interest to me. Then I went to the London Library when I was still an undergraduate. And or young Don, and you get shelf access. You can look at shelves in the London Library. So I looked at all the Russian shelves. There were the works of Herzen. Since I knew the name, I took out a volume. And I began reading it. It absolutely fascinated me. The first two pages. So I borrowed it, volume by volume, became totally transported by it. I think it must have been... Yes, certainly not late. I think it must have been... Well, I don't know, maybe it was in 33 or 4, but it may have been in 1931. It's round about there. It was very soon after I became a member of the London Library. That's verifiable from his books. I can't remember when that happened. I think it must have been one. I think a Don. I think probably 33, 34.
So you were absorbed by
Herzen? Absolutely. I thought it was the most marvelous book I ever read. Most marvelous book I ever read. My past thoughts. I still think it. I became totally interested. Then I remember I read at some point E.H. Carr's book called The Romantic Exiles. With great pleasure and amusement. I didn't then particularly react to Yeats as I did later. I think I read it, in fact, just about the time I was reading Herzen. It appeared about then, I think.
And, I mean, reading Herzen had already the impact it had on you while, I mean, formulating your opinions on...
It had a permanent impact. It had more great impact on me, so to speak, as far as my opinions are concerned, than any book I'd ever read. Not philosophically, not really in the literary sense, but opinions.
So one should mention it even before mentioning writing about Marx.
It happened during the writing about Marx. And I was amused how much Herzen disliked Marx. And I saw why he disliked him too. He disliked me personally. He said that most revolutionaries had quarrels among themselves after they were in exile. But such dirty linen as the Germans washed amongst themselves, these awful rows of a quarrel among Germans, were disgusting. The French, the Italians, didn't behave like that.
But you never lectured about Russian thinkers or...
Before the war, no.
In Oxford, no.
Certainly not. There would have been no audience for it.
Were there any friends of yours whom you could discuss it with?
No, there were not. Never did. I never was able to discuss history with other people at all, you know, all my life. That region of thought has nobody talked. In England, hardly anyone. History idea is not an English subject. I know of no historian of ideas with whom I had protracted discussions. In America, yes. Some people said. In England, nobody. Whom could I possibly have talked about? I mean, Popper was then not in England. He's in New Zealand then. Who could I have talked to? Stuart, I'm sure it wasn't all that interesting ideas.
I was coming to Popper later, but so now, when did you meet Popper?
Met whom?
Popper.
Well, technically, I mean...
When did you meet
Popper? Much later. I met Popper when he first came from Vienna, which was, and before he went abroad, about 1937 and so on, before the Anschluss. Freddie and I gave him tea in Lion's Corner House. And I thought he was a very nice, interesting man. He had never been a professor, I explained it. Then he went to New Zealand. We became friends, because he stayed in England for a while. Then he came to, may have come for a short time to England, after the Anschluss, but in the end went off to New Zealand.
And you and your role was New Zealand?
Yes, he was. And then he wrote this book called The Open Society and Its Enemies that he wrote in New Zealand. It was his contribution to the war, because Plato is really Hitler. And fundamentally, communist Nazis, I mean people whose doctrines he thought led to the war. And then I read it when it first appeared. And it made a very powerful impression on me. I realized that the chapter on Plato, the chapter on Aristotle, the chapter on Hegel were no good. The quotations are very interesting, but the fundamental interpretation could not stand up.
Because it was
too violent, too extreme. I mean, and Aristotle too. Yes, Plato for him invented what he called essentialism. The metaphysical necessity of things necessarily being what they are. Of course, he was also a believer in free will, and that increased my admiration for him. Naturally, among the few philosophers. But the chapter on Stuart Mill I thought was good, and the chapter on Marx I thought was really interesting. That impressed me. Still does. But wasn't that the general impact of the book? Why, even if everything in it is inaccurate and so on, the little thesis seemed to be absolutely right. I mean, the dangers of, as it were, metaphysical doctrines and doctrinaireness as such. That's when I became convinced that belief in final solutions, belief in doctrines was always dangerous. Herzen began that, because the original denunciation of doctrines as such is Herzen. He is a man probably echoing Max Stirner, which I didn't know at the time, perhaps when I first read him, who says the modern form of idolatry is doctrines. People are brought as sacrifices on the altar, physically, I mean killed, for the sake of these abstractions. And you see, and that's he already said in the 1840s. And he said that this belief in some kind of ultimate felicity for the sake of which these sacrifices are brought is always wrong. It's like there's a great passage in From the Other Shore, not in my personal thoughts, where he says these ideals are like Moloch, God who constantly lures you towards himself, and as you come nearer, it always recedes backwards. In other words, the victims are there, but the felicity doesn't happen. Purposes must be closer than that. Remote ends are not ends. So there must be some kind of reward for your work at the end of the day. It mustn't be tomorrow. All sacrifice for tomorrow risk being disappointed, the risk fails and the victims are there. I think that's the first person. Really. I think Marx Stirner may have said it, but it's a wonderful anti-Marxist antidote. Considering he was a socialist and had ideals of his own and so on, it was a thing which deeply, deeply impressed me. And Popper did exactly the same, without having read Herzen or knowing anything about him.
So,
as far as I know.
You
articulated in wait a moment. Already in 1938-9, I began reading Bielinski. That was the London Library. Or 30, 34, 35. London Library again.
Something you wrote about maybe
I didn't write anything about him earlier, but I began reading him again in the London Library. Same shelf. How about you see? And that impressed me. I suddenly realized that Yeah, I was a free thinker who was obviously liberal and so on, but who was not didn't lie what is called a comfortable bit of dogma. And he struck me as a deeply humanist figure who was personally sympathetic. His views seemed to me to be sympathetic to a degree. He was a genuine man who really followed what he really believed and what his heart told him. He was not a slave to any kind of theories or doctrines. That always pleased me. And so between them, they created my interest in the antecedents of the Russian Revolution. That plus Marx. Then I used to read Belinsky during the war in Washington. I took a single volume. It was sort of pre-war volume, non-Soviet volume of his, no, Soviet maps, of his writings.